2023 cut. Any takers?
No, not that one.
Nah, that didn't really work for me.
Not that. Okay, fine.
NGL.
2023, three of us, three sides to a triangle, deep cut confirmed Illuminati.
There we go. I'm there with you. I'm there. Ben's still not convinced.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm not buying what you're selling here.
I don't need your approval. Just kidding, I do.
I'm Wilson Lai.
I'm Benjamin Yap.
I'm Eli Sands.
You're listening to Deep Cut.
On Deep Cut, we usually compare a director's most popular film with a personal favorite chosen by one of us.
We also usually discuss a director's life and career to bring in context that helps us view their movies as they may want us to.
Before we get into our 2023 year in review, which will be hopefully not a super long and chunky, but long and chunky enough that you have quite a few movies to add to your watch list, be sure to subscribe to us where you listen to podcasts. You can drop us a review. You can also keep up with us on Instagram and Letterboxd at Deep Cut Pod. And you can talk to us about movies and more on our Discord server, to which you'll find a link in the description. Heads up, once this episode drops, I think we're all going to drop our long lists on the Discord. So come check it out. Firstly, let me lay out how we're going to talk about our year in movie and TV watching. So we're going to do a general overview first, where each of us talks about our year in movie and TV watching, and then we'll jump into honorable mentions from each of us, and finishing off with our top three movies of 2023. So let's get the ball rolling, guys. Let's not waste any time. How was your 2023 year in movie and TV watching, Ben?
It was fine.
Yeah.
I think 2023 was weirdly a bit of a disappointment because there were so many auteurs coming out with like big movies, but none that really took me completely that I was hoping for. Were they good movies? Yes, but they weren't like good movies that I love. If you guys catch my drift.
I think I do.
But it was definitely a very exciting year for movies in terms of new movies to watch. For me, the big thing in TV watching is that 2023 was the year that I decided to watch anime.
Yeah.
And that really just destroyed my watching time because I watch so much anime that I can't even keep up with TV anymore because I'm just watching anime constantly on my commute.
Incredible. I'm so proud of you, Ben.
I'm going to shout out some really quick ones. Scott Pilgrim Takes Off is really good. It is anime, even though it's in English. It's by Sain Saru, same company that Masaaki Yuasa is in, but he didn't actually work on this.
Wasn't. He's gone now.
He's gone? I didn't know that.
He left Sain Saru.
That's a scoop.
This year.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the biggest animes in Japan right now, Spy X Family, is fantastic. I'm going to show you guys this thing I have that I bought.
He's rolling away from the mic.
Rolling back. What does he have?
It's Anya.
A little statuette.
Oh, so cute.
From Spy Family, which I love because I watch a show and I laugh. And Bocchi the Rock I really love. Attack on Titan finally finished. Really good series. And I watched this really old one called Nana, which I really, really love. Super dated, but also really good and quite unique, I think. And for TV, I want to shout out Reservation Dogs, which nobody's talking about, which I probably is my favorite TV show of last year. Even more so than some of the more big prestige films, because Res Dogs just gets character, gets community, and is able to build this world in this reservation that it is set in. That's my TV watching, I guess.
Nice.
Nice.
On to you, Eli.
Okay. Yeah. I think I've been thinking about my year in movie watching in the context of what kind of year it was overall, both personally and globally, being alive during this time. Professionally and personally, this is a year when I've been more busy than I ever have before, and due to that, I've watched fewer movies than I have in the last handful of years since our time at university together. And then globally, it's a weird time to be alive, and I think it's fair to say a dark time to be alive. all those things have made me really think about why I watch movies, or I've been reevaluating what I want in movies.
Right.
In trying to put my finger on it. It is, in one way or another, movies that engage with this moment. And that has led me to things that are incisive and angry, or things that are calm and pleasant, but also in their own way engaging with what it means to be alive and functional right now. As we go through our movies, I'll sort of maybe do some categorization around that. But to me, I'm really looking for art that has that instructional utility or application and is leaning into the discomfort of life right now in different ways. I'll also say, per Ben's note on TV watching, that my single favorite piece of audiovisual media of the past year was hands down Succession season 4.
So great. What a great season.
It's the best. It's completely troubling and ugly while moving with a lot of compassion. It's kind of the thing to me that straddles both categories, where it's certainly angry and it is very wounded. We could spend a whole episode talking about Succession,
which we kept saying we would do, but we didn't.
Yeah. Whoops.
BTS.
It's never too late to go back. But it's also the thing that I find myself thinking about the most from this past year and revisiting and watching episodes and clips again. It's really staying with me. And I still have more unpacking to do, even, 6 months out from the end of the show.
Yeah. I remember last year when we were talking about these, like, rich people stuck on an island movies.
Yeah.
And I feel like we completely missed this sort of, like, it was, like, sitting right in front of us that Succession was such a great portrait of the top 1% that feels very necessary still in this climate.
Yeah, whereas those movies get stuck on blaming individuals for the ills of wealth.
Right.
Succession has a really firm grasp on the system around wealth and what exactly enables wealth to perpetuate itself and enact evil in the world.
Yeah, great.
We'll save that for maybe a future surprise episode. Wilson, what about you? 2023 in movies.
Yeah, it was a crazy movie watching year. I don't think I watched as much as I wanted to watch, and I feel like I really got bogged down by new releases. Not saying that the new releases weren't good. I feel like I err on the other side of the argument from Ben when I say that a lot of, like, the great auteur director comebacks or, like, big projects that were released this year really worked for me for the most part. So I'm very, like, grateful for this year in cinema. And I feel like I was at the movies, like, at a physical cinema a lot more this year.
Oh.
Which I'm very happy about.
Same, actually.
Yeah.
Same. I forgot to mention that.
Yeah.
I watched almost 100 movies in the cinema this last year.
Wow. That's awesome, Ben.
Sorry, Wilson. Please continue.
I think that's such an essential, like, part to movie watching now. Like, now, if I were to choose to watch a movie on my computer screen versus wait maybe a week or two for it to come out in cinemas here in Hong Kong, I would often just wait for the theatrical release, which I'm very happy about. Like,
same.
I think we all should be supporting a movie-going experience, like a collective movie-going experience, because it's something that's so special and, like, something that's just so true to, I think, the core of cinema, and that we should continue to practice from here on out.
The way that cinemas straddle individual and communal experience is something that does feel kind of sacred and unique.
Yeah. And yeah, most of the movies on my picks, I was lucky enough to see in the theater. As for TV, I honestly, guys, like, I fell into a Survivor hole this year, and, like, I probably watched, like, 10 seasons of Survivor this year.
Been hearing about this for a long time. That's absolutely insane.
How would you do on Survivor, Wilson? What would be your strategy? How would you fare in the competition?
I think about it all the time, and I think every season that I watch is research for me to take information on how people are playing the game.
This is doomsday prepping.
And, well, it's not just survival, right? It's like, it's a social game. You have to one-up other people. You need to lie. You need to deceive people. I think it's very interesting. You, like, observe social dynamics. I'm not going to speak more, but I will say that the newest season, which is season 45, is really, really good. So if anyone wants to start
45,
yeah, they release two seasons a year. So it's been like half the amount of years since it started, but it's been a long time.
45 years.
And it's still going strong. It's like doing really well in ratings. So go watch that. But I also really loved, I guess, similarly in a similar kind of reality TV area, I really loved Jury Duty this year, which was this small show on
Peacock,
Amazon it's an ad supported streaming service. But that's really, really good. And I don't want to spoil it. It's so funny and a really great, easy watch. Yeah, that's it. That's my movie and TV watching for 2023.
Awesome. As always, it's fun to see your reviews on the things that you're watching and talk about what we've been watching, too.
Yeah.
Wilson, I know that you just came off your experiment of writing a review for every movie that you watch.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. That was the whole thing.
Actually, yeah, I want to speak a little bit about that. Please. My 2023 goal for Letterboxd was to write something substantial on every single thing that I watched that year. And I did manage to do it. And I think it was a great exercise to have. And as someone who, I guess, before always favored doing like the one sentence like joke review rather than like thinking about a movie and trying to like sort of boil that down into a few paragraphs, it was tough, but I think I'm glad that I forced myself to do it, and now I can just rest and not do that for a long time. But it's great, and I feel like I was able to think about movies a lot more, even though I was sort of sometimes I was like dreading watching a movie because I realized that I would have to write a review on it. But yeah, both sides to the coin.
Guys, I just shook up my top 10 list. As I was staring at it, I shook up my top 10 list.
Oh my God.
What the shit?
He just shuffled it. He pressed shuffle.
Nah, not really. A little bit.
If I can shout out a couple of my favorite reviews of yours from this past year, from Wilson, Lost Love, and The Creator. And from Ben, your review of The Makanai, Cooking for the Maiko House, and Millennium Mambo. Those are good reads. Go look for them.
The Millennium Mambo one's barely a review.
Damn, Eli, I need to go to your letterbox now.
I'm going to shout out all of Eli's reviews because they're all good.
Yeah, they are.
I don't have any specific one in mind.
It's true.
Well, shucks. Thank you both. That's kind.
Okay.
Well, maybe let's roll into talking about some movies from 2023 that we want to do a little brief aside on. I've come to really look forward to this, and it's part of how I think about my movie watching in the year. Like, what am I going to have to say about it? What do I want to ask Wilson and Ben about it? I think to kick it off, maybe let's get a big convo out of the way.
Let's do it.
First.
Let's do it.
Oppenheimer and Barbie. We teased this on our, I think, showing up episode. And there was a bit of a disagreement brewing amongst us.
Yeah, I was unhappy.
So, Wilson, I want to know, what do you love about Oppenheimer? What grabbed you?
I think Oppenheimer is the culmination of Christopher Nolan's life work. Sorry, I'm laughing, but I'm very, very serious where I say that I think very rarely does Nolan do stuff that is very character focused I think it's more like plot focused, but I think this, where he sort of channels this energy of propulsive filmmaking into a story that is quite internal, feels very novel for him. And I think for me, it really worked. And I watched this twice in the theater because I think there's just such a distinct way that he edits this movie and all his movies, where I think not a lot of other directors can actually replicate. And I think that's why it really stands tall in this year of filmmaking, because of this propulsive storytelling combined with this really intimate character study that I found to be very fascinating. And like the themes of, I guess, like having the weight of the world on your shoulder, or like making these horrible decisions that will like affect a lot of other people for the sake of your like craft or your art or your science.
Mm.
Like I feel like I can think about that for days. And Cillian Murphy is outstanding in this movie. Mm. I never really paid attention to him before watching Oppenheimer. So yeah, it's a 5-star movie for me with a rewatch, which like sort of confirms a 5-star in my head. Like I feel like you watch a movie for the first time, you give it 5 stars, and then you watch a movie again to just make sure that it's actually 5 stars. And I made sure.
This is why I never sure. do that. This is why I never do that.
Never revisit. Never look back.
Yeah, but it's number 4 this year for me.
Ooh.
It's quite high up.
Ooh, you're already doing the numbers. Hmm.
Ah. I know Ben and Eli felt a little dissimilar to me about Oppenheimer.
You're wrong, because it's number 5 for me, you fucker.
Oh, <whoa. laughs> You hold a gun to my face. You're like,
wow.
Joke's on you, asswipe.
You're wrong.
I think it's just a very strong sense of craft that he has with this film. Do I think it's very intelligent? No. But I also don't think a lot of the films in my top 10 are very intelligent. And I don't think films have to be too intelligent to be good times.
Yeah, what is intelligence
yeah.
in filmmaking?
And I have to say, an hour ago, I was sitting on the toilet with my phone, as people do, watching an Instagram reel of Stephen Colbert interviewing Christopher Nolan. And it's Nolan revealing that he's a Fast and the Furious fan.
Lit.
And when you really think about it, Oppenheimer is kind of a very good Fast and the Furious movie.
Oh my God.
Like as an action movie, it's like kind of a heist movie. It's kind of a get the team together movie. It's kind of a movie about family.
Oh.
So it kind of makes sense that he's a Fast and the Furious fan. Like those are trashy movies. And in a way, he's kind of like making a version of that kind of movie. Not really, but I've not actually seen many of them.
I don't know. I feel like Inception is closer to a Fast and Furious movie than
sure.
Oppenheimer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I see
Yeah,
that.
Definitely. But I mean, I would say that the editing is the thing that gets me about Oppenheimer yeah. because no other movie that is 3 hours long and got so many people in the theater is edited in such a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like a mainstream regular audience was forced to be exposed to something so experimental
mm-hmm.
in something that kind of does work for a very large swath of audiences. And I think that is a big feat as a act of filmmaking craft.
Yeah.
To put that in front of people and trust that it works. I think that's really quite commendable.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it's pretty good.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, and to specify what that editing is doing, first of all, shout out Jennifer Lame, because she's clearly proven herself a genius yeah. editor across mm-hmm. her body of work already.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that is so experimental and fascinating about it is that in the buildup to the Trinity test of the first atom bomb, the edit is like rushing. It feels like it is moving too quickly and shots are cut like a beat too short.
Yeah, it's like tripping over itself.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And to Wilson's point about the thematic examination of the movie, it's rushing and not considering consequences to get to that point of artistic or scientific fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, when the consequences are weighing on Oppenheimer, the edit slows down painfully so, and shots are held for longer during these uncomfortable hearings and grillings. So I totally agree, Ben, that as an experimental, novel, fresh edit, it's really fascinating that it has mm-hmm. hit so big.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I do agree with what Ben said about the sort of limited, if not intelligence, then substantial take
mm-hmm.
on Oppenheimer or the consequences of nuclear weaponry beyond just sort of a generalized anxiety about it. And I hold that against the movie a little bit more, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't maybe fully as responsible
mm-hmm.
with examining those things as it should be.
I mean, it doesn't really examine, really.
Yeah.
No.
And
yeah.
I think it is sitting behind its idea that it is a character study, which I get. And I think this is more of an expectation versus what I got from the film kind of thing.
Right.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it needs to do that. It's just kind of I wish it did. And
yeah.
that's kind of why it's just not like a personal fave.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I feel a responsibility in approaching that subject matter that it should be dealt with. Like, I find a very telling choice that in the scene where Oppenheimer is being shown projected images of the victims of Hiroshima, we don't see those images, even though he is seeing that and we're ostensibly in his subjectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And then earlier on, when he's post-explosion in Hiroshima, he's imagining his teammates facing a nuclear blast and being torn apart, that is shown of these white American people being affected.
Right.
That feels like comforting an American audience by not having to confront in a visceral way the effects this weaponry's invention. Mm-hmm. I find that a bit condemnable.
I have a question for you, Eli, but I think I'm going to hold it till after we talk about Barbie so we can talk about both movies together.
Sure.
Okay.
It's almost certainly going to win Best Picture, right?
Ooh.
No.
I don't know, but
I don't know.
Probably? I don't know.
You don't think so?
I think this competition's a bit tight this year.
Perhaps.
It's a toss-up, I think.
Who knows? Yeah.
It could. Hmm. It could. It could.
I guess we'll see.
So it's hard not to talk about Oppenheimer without bringing up the movie that came out on the same day, Barbie, and they both sort of propelled each other to financial success.
Yeah, fascinating.
In my opinion. But I think a great marketing strategy that both marketing teams jumped on once it was clear to them that people were really talking about it. I think Barbie was less strong of a directorial work than Oppenheimer and also Gerwig's past features. I think it was still a really interesting thing that she did with existing toy IP. And I feel like this is starting a wave of a lot of different companies trying to replicate the same thing, but I don't think they will get as close to what Gerwig and Baumbach did with this Barbie script.
Seen it from a mile away.
Yeah. It's playful. It's quite fun to watch, and I understand the four quadrant appeal that this movie has, and I'm glad everyone's here for it and spent money on this. And all props to Gerwig and team.
I like Barbie. It is number 8 on my list.
It's number 7 for me.
Because I had a good time. I watched it on my birthday with a friend. We were a little drunk and I had a good time.
Nice.
And I think most of it comes down to also, similar to Oppenheimer, I think, a bit of a gambit as a film.
Yeah.
Right. How do you turn this thing into, literal thing into a movie that has no story? And I think they do succeed.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I rate it higher because of the fact that it is working within the constraints of something that is kind of a difficult juggling act.
Mm. Right.
How do you do IP movie and also kind of make it work in this way that it's a unique production? So I think the credit goes to not just Gerwig, but also, I guess, Margot Robbie, who's a producer on this.
Yeah.
And the way they were able to package this for an audience as well as for a client, essentially. Because Mattel is a client for the film.
Yeah.
That, as a craft of the business of filmmaking, is quite interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the way that they were able to slice it through the middle, that's quite impressive, I think, that they were able to do that.
Well said.
So I think that's really why I think I had a lot of fun with Barbie. I think from a production design standpoint and a performance standpoint, it also is pretty fun. And yeah, as Wilson said, a great four quadrant movie. So yeah, it was a pretty good year for blockbusters, I think.
Yeah.
It was probably my favorite comedy of the year.
Oh yeah.
Actually, definitely.
Oh, interesting. It was not mine.
Barbie's 37 on my list.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that I didn't enjoy it.
I guess I didn't see a ton of comedy this year.
I also think talking about Barbie, we can also talk about the general state of Hollywood filmmaking. And I'm so glad, because the past few years I've been sort of ragging on these fucking superhero movies and saying how done I was. And I think this year the general audience is sort of followed suit. I think everyone was we don't want this anymore. We don't want sub-tier filmmaking with these action figure dolls, superheroes that churn a lot of money into and not a lot of effort, creative effort and oversight into. And I think it's showing. The cracks are beginning to widen. Mm-hmm. And I think the superhero movie industry is going to be setting up for a massive crash in the next few years, which I'm really crossing my fingers for. Sorry, I know a lot of people will lose jobs, but I hope it's happening.
It's kind of already crashed.
Yeah.
It's already kind of crashed. And I think from you saying that, I realized I don't really watch much mainstream Hollywood movies this year. I don't think I watched that many of them. I'm looking at my list now.
Yeah, I don't think I did either.
That's actually a good thing for me, because I think I was able to seek out more interesting movies that I wanted to watch.
Yeah.
Mainstream superhero movies are thriving in the animated realm, though.
Ooh. Sure.
I will say that I enjoyed both Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse and the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem movies quite a bit, both.
Yeah, I loved Across the Spider-Verse.
I liked Spider-Man.
Yeah, it's my 8th spot.
I didn't really particularly like Ninja Turtles. But I watched it on a plane, so it was a little different. A little bit of a different experience.
It's not perfect. It's fun.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a big question for Eli. So you were talking about how Oppenheimer, when they were you never really saw Oppenheimer come to terms with the atrocities that he committed or he helped commit. Similarly, I just watched last night, I watched The Zone of Interest.
Oh boy.
I was like looking for your review on it, Eli, because you said you had a lot to say about it.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find it.
I've not published it yet.
I was really deeply moved and like sort of disgusted by that movie. But I think it does a similar thing where you're not really confronted face to face with the atrocities that were happening at Auschwitz behind this family that you see living. But I think in its sound design and like how in a lot of the shots in the top third of the shot, you see the concentration camp behind the wall, it really moved me to a degree that I really haven't with a lot of other films that came out this year, like maybe all the other films save for one. And it just made me feel horrible by the end of it. Like, I think I'm still reeling from my watch last night. And I want to hear from you, who's had a lot more time to sit with this movie and think about it, what you thought of The Zone of Interest.
Yeah. Well, so I saw it a little bit over a month ago. Full disclosure, in the time since then, I've been working on a long form piece of writing, partially in order to figure out what my thoughts on this movie are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really struggling with it. Just to preface it, whatever I say here is thoughts in motion. It's taking me a long time. I notoriously online have a complicated relationship with movies about the Holocaust. With this one, about 80% of the runtime was exactly what I expected it to be from the trailers and from what I'd heard, which is that placid view of the Haas's everyday life with the, as you're describing in the upper third, you know, or in the soundscape, hints of the atrocities that bolster their everyday comforts.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that the movie makes that aesthetic and narrative choice to be very critically cold and distant in order to prompt an intellectual engagement with how they build their peace and everyday life on top of the horrors of Auschwitz happening just over their back wall.
Yeah.
This can lead to the sort of autocritical questioning of what do we build our own peace off of day to day? What do we abide by?
Mm.
And the problem there is that that's something I grasp intellectually, having just seen the trailers and heard about the movie and the premise. And furthermore, from having read about the Holocaust. And furthermore, from being Jewish in the 21st century and being alive in the 21st century and thinking all the time about the ways in which my life exists on top of suffering. It's an unresolvable problem and one worth exploring in film, I would argue.
Mm.
But that requires a nuance that I don't think The Zone of Interest possesses. To make a movie about that problem in a vaunted, I would argue, semi-self-congratulatory art house milieu is perhaps a bit naive on Glazer's part and morally perhaps simplistic. What I'm looking for is something more or something new to say. Those passages of the movie just left me with a feeling of, and what else is here? When it comes to what the movie does differently, there are peaks of something a little bit more wrinkled and nuanced at the end, but they're very dark things. There also is something kind of novel and really interesting to me here in what the Haases gain by working at Auschwitz and living this life. It's implied that the Haas family came from a lower status and have gained a lot of social capital by operating Auschwitz. Haas's wife especially seems to relish those social benefits. She both actively disregards the atrocities that are providing her with those benefits, and she scorns anyone and anything that at all risks some kind of moral judgment on that manner of profit. And then there's sort of the other section, which is the night vision sequences where Mika Levy's score comes in and someone is planting food for the camp inmates.
That's so good.
With all of these things, I get the point, and I'm sort of asking, and? Because these are ideas that I've encountered before, thematically. We all know the banality of evil. I think my conclusion is that those ideas and these narratives about the Holocaust, both on the side of perpetrators and survivors, I prefer to encounter outside the medium of film.
Mm.
It's not where I need to go at this moment, at least.
Mm-hmm.
I find the zone of interest perhaps formally daring, but also a little bit formally grotesque.
Yeah.
I'm not really into what it is selling at this moment.
Mm.
And having said that, that could change. I don't know if I'll be rewatching it anytime soon, but I'm certainly continuing to digest it through the act of writing. Maybe that will be online someday.
I'm looking forward to it.
Ben, did you watch it?
No, I don't know when I'll be able to watch it.
For me, it was really quite haunting. It worked. Like, I don't think there was like questions in my mind until after I watched it where it was like, oh, why? Why was this made?
Yeah.
And trying to think around intention. But I do think that there's a really interesting way that Glazer holds you at a distance and doesn't allow you to sort of connect with the Haas family, even though you see them for most of the screen time of the movie. And it's just really cold and an unmoving portrait of these people. And like, what sticks with me is not really their actions, but what is sort of unseen, or what is heard and but not seen, or what is implied but not shown. Yeah. And I think also like the construction of the film is really interesting, and how they shot with multiple cameras at once. And it wasn't a heavy hand, I guess, from the camera's perspective, but I think it led to a effective outcome for me.
Hmm. I'm going to speak a bit brashly. And again, my thought on this may change. To me, that distance puts us, the audience, in a position of moral superiority that I find a bit cowardly and naive.
Mm.
I again find myself coming back to this question of why these choices and why this movie, and what is it really adding here?
Mm. I see myself asking you similar questions about a different movie, Wilson.
Is it the one by Scorsese?
I don't know. Is it?
Well, if you ask me the one about Scorsese, but I think we have to end with it. We have to end the whole thing with it. So
yes,
I don't want
I
to
know.
Talk about it right now.
I already know that.
Okay, sweet, cool. We can move on to other honorable mentions.
I already knew that. I have a top 10. Should we just run down the top 10?
Yes.
Before the top 3, and then we can talk a little bit more about the top 3.
Yes.
So, I mean, we've talked about Oppenheimer and Barbie, which are both in my top 10, actually.
Wow.
Which is surprising and fun, actually. I really benefited from Barbenheimer.
It was fruitful.
I'm going to start with my first honorable mention, which is number 10 on my list. I watched this last night, and I just shuffled my list when I was staring at it. And this is How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
Yes!
Yeah!
Which I thought was very lean,
yes!
Muscular movie.
Good adjectives.
Very well-made, simple, but structurally also quite interesting with the flashback structure. So I thought that was very well-made. And there's something about it that felt put together, but not in an auteur sense, which I found very fascinating. That it didn't feel like it was really trying to announce itself as, oh, I'm this cool new movie. It was just, let me make this movie just exactly how it should be, and I'm just going to do it, bam, bam, bam.
Yeah.
And ethically, I don't know how I feel about it, but
Yes. Pretty
interesting. And I can see why I had to watch this online. I don't think this will ever come out in Singapore. Yeah. Definitely a movie you watch and get put on a list for.
Yeah.
How to Blow Up Pipeline.
I loved How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
You guys both like this as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said in your review, Ben, something really great that sort of ties to your point you were making about the film, how it's sort of like ego-less filmmaking. And you really see it in the credits as well. It's like co-written by a few of the stars.
Yeah.
A lot of the stars produced it.
Yeah.
It is truly an ensemble piece. I don't think you can really single out someone as like a lead or a main character.
Yeah.
And everyone carries their own weight. Everyone has their own backstory. It moves like a machine.
Yeah.
It's chugging through like so much. And it sort of reminded me of the pacing of like something like a Nolan flick in the way that it just didn't.
It's like kind of like Oppenheimer.
It didn't stop. Yeah. Ethically speaking, like whatever, fuck it, put me on a list or whatever, but I really dug it. Like I really fucked with it. Like I like was like, if you can't do this type of activism in real life, I think the second best thing to do is to show people how to do it in movies. Sorry. Sorry. I didn't mean it. Any government operatives listening?
The comments made by Wilson are not deep cuts. All comments made by hosts on the show are their own.
That's all I'm going to say about how to...
It was a bit. It was a bit. I meant in Minecraft.
It was a bit. It was a joke.
Last year, my favorite book that I read was...
How to Blow Up a Pipeline?
No. Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson, which I talked a little bit on mic last year, I think, and it really pragmatically addresses what this moment is in terms of climate and our planet.
Mm-hmm.
I feel similarly about How to Blow Up a Pipeline. This slots into my category from earlier of things that are incisive and angry and really have a moral argument to them. Whether or not you agree with that argument, it exists and it is strong and it makes the movie more compelling.
Okay, Nick, somebody else.
Great. My number 10 pick, similar vein, I think, but in a sort of gentler kind of way, is Evil Does Not Exist by Ryusuke Hamaguchi.
Ooh.
Both of you know that I love Hamaguchi and his filmmaking, and
sure
this
do.
Is sort of a crazy turn after his Oscar-winning Drive My Car. He said that he wanted to take like a pivot after Drive My Car and do something really small, and this is about a small town in Japan and a corporation that wants to come in and build a glamping site there, and the residents fighting back against it. And I think similarly speaks to themes of climate crisis and preserving the environment and this sort of way of life that you can have there. It reminded me of a lot of my time in Japan this year as well. So that's why I really loved it. So that's Evil Does Not Exist. It's opening in New York this week, but go check it out.
Ooh, okay, cool.
I'm waiting for it to come
out. Cool.
Eli, what's your next pick?
Eli Does Not Exist. It's not in my top 10, but I'll throw out Ari Aster's latest, Bo is Afraid.
Ooh.
Mostly because I'm still thinking about it. It's not a movie I even necessarily like, but it is pretty bold and adventurous, and there are passages of it that I think are really compelling. On the other hand, it goes very literal and reductive in some places and really hurts the movie overall. But there's something kind of undeniable to it at the core. I remain on the Ari Aster train. People told me I was really going to hate this one, and I don't outright hate it. I'm just looking forward to what he has to offer next.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope he gets back together working with Jennifer Lame, because clearly she helps him structure in a way that I think his movies benefit from.
Mm-hmm. Great. Didn't care for it.
Back to you, Ben.
Back to me.
Ben is Afraid.
Number 9 for me is the Lea Seydoux starring Mia Hansen Love film, One Fine Morning, which I don't even know if this is a 2023 movie, but I guess this thing kind of slotted right into my Romarian kind of interests. I've never really been big on Hansen Love, but this is the first one that really kind of got me. It also co-stars the lead dude from A Summer's Tale, which I was like looking at this man. I was like, who is this man? Why does he look so familiar? And I was like, oh yeah, he's an annoying little kid from A Summer's Tale. But anyway.
Now he's old.
I thought it was really good because you just get a really strong sense of Seydoux's character and you just really feel her as a person. And it's, you know, French and sexy and she's like, there's affairs going on, of course. It's just really quite simple and I really liked it for that kind of character study and depiction. That's really all I have to say about it.
Love that.
Yeah, it just made me feel something and like think about it as I was watching it and I liked it.
Is there a moment from it that's sticking with you?
Let me think. Well, it's been a bit of time.
There's a scene on a bus where she's sitting there and she just goes through so many emotions on her face at the same time that really moved me from that movie.
Oh, I love those moments.
I put it on my 2022 list, but I similarly really loved it and also really love Mia Hansen loves filmmaking.
I just liked it.
Yeah.
There isn't really any one moment. Like, I think you kind of live with it and it's just kind of feels like real life, especially with the filmmaking and the way that it is. Yeah, I think about the way their sexual relationship kind of progresses as well.
Yeah.
Like the way that it uses sex in their relationship, like sometimes he's like kind of just in it for the sex and sometimes he's not and she kind of is in it for the sex. So like that is kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Like what they want shifts across time.
Yeah. And the whole backstory of it being like this thing where he's her late husband's friend as well is also kind of fascinating. And the kids were still really good.
The pacing and structuring of the film is also really, I think, really well done. And it's very gentle.
Yeah.
And it sort of sways back and forth between her sexual relationship and also her relationship with her father, who is losing his memory.
And is ill,
Yeah.
I think I want to watch this.
It's great.
I think you'll like it. I think, especially this kind of film, you really just need a central performance that works and a character that you care about and that will seal the deal. And I think in the previous Hansen love films I've watched, I didn't have that. I think Lisa Doo is just so good.
Yeah, she's a great actress.
In general, you know? That's kind of what makes it for me.
Yeah.
Moving on.
My number 9 film is Rainn Alan Miller's directorial debut, Rye Lane, starring David Johnson and Vivian Oprah.
Oh.
It's such a lovely rom-com, and I think I've just been seeking that in my life or seeking that in the film world this year, and it really delivered. I love the colors. I love the anamorphic cinematography. It's genuinely hilarious, like a lot of the time. And this romance at the center of it is so infectious. Yeah, I don't think it's just a lovely time. I don't think that there's anything I would say that sort of goes against this movie. I like really, really support it. And I think a lot of people slept on it when it came out earlier last year.
Yeah, I thought this was charming. Although I would say the colors were a bit too much for me.
His eyes couldn't handle it.
That's just me, though. It was like a little too much for me.
We have to desaturate things for him.
Yeah.
Like a mother bird chewing its food.
Yeah, maybe I should just turn down my screen. Do my own color correction. Anyway.
Well, similar to Ben's pick of a character study that is anchored around a super strong central performance, I know this was on your list last year, but Return to Seoul really left a mark on me. It's about a young woman struggling and arguably failing to find what is at the core of herself and believing that she is alone in this struggle. That belief of isolation making things harder for her. As a performance that varies so wildly across its 4 chapters, that Park Ji-min finds that coherence that the character cannot grasp is such a tightrope walk. It's so compelling. I think the direction is really electric and the use of music, the way she dances and moves. It's just always gripping to watch and watch scenes with Freddie play out because she's very volatile, but also very sensitive and hurt. It's just such a compelling thing to see play out across a movie. It's quite sad. And also enlivening, full of tension, productively.
Great movie.
Really, really incredible movie. Return to Seoul. Check it out.
And listen to what Wilson said about it last year. I re-listened and it's a lovely section.
Aw, thanks, Eli. Okay, Ben.
All right. I'm skipping 8 because that was Barbie. And I'm going to a very controversial pick because I know Wilson hates this movie.
Ooh.
And I liked it. And it's Lucas Daunt's Close.
Ah. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Extremely controversial pick, I know. And I know exactly where Wilson's coming from. I'll let him speak for himself. But I thought it worked for me in this melodramatic way, which I think speaks more to maybe the kind of content it is. And how I thought it, in terms of like the kind of story it was, like felt very close to what I have, I won't say experienced, but like close to feelings I've felt. Yeah, and I think that kind of exploration of what it means to be masculine and like that fear of what is thought of as not masculine is interesting to me and it's always fascinated me just in general. And there's like a scene in this movie that feels ripped out from myself, which is crazy. Yeah, so I think that kind of like was the thing. And there was this thing that I noticed about the film, which is its use of color, which I thought was really quite interesting, almost like an old school Technicolor color theory, color chart kind of thing, which I haven't really seen a modern movie do. And it's very subtle. It's not in your face. And I thought it was quite effective as well. I think as like a sad movie, it's probably the sad movie that worked on me the most this year. Mm-hmm. That's kind of why it's on my list.
That makes sense.
But I don't know if Wilson wants to say his piece. Or you don't have to, if you don't want to.
I agree. I think the color theory is great. And I think the performances of the kids are really strong. But I just don't think Lucas Don't should be allowed to make movies anymore. I think he's doing stuff like, I think he's like doing stuff like targeting the queer community in really horrible ways with this movie and his previous film, Girl. I just think he's like this misconstrued vision of queer youth that is sort of, I don't know, stretched and strained for our entertainment and our empathy feels so off to me. I can understand how it works for a lot of people because it's emotionally effective. Like, I understand it is designed to make you feel horrible watching it or make you feel really sad watching it. But I was feeling the feelings, but I was sort of pissed off that I was feeling the feelings because it just felt, it felt like it was coming from a not very great place. But I don't know. Don't said it was based on his experience or like similar experiences growing up. So I don't want to discredit that, but just not for me.
Yeah.
Really not for me.
Something that's interesting to talk about. I'm not going to go too far into this, but I think whether you read this as necessarily a film about queer characters is might land you differently. I think maybe because I don't squarely put this as a film necessarily about queer characters, and also because they're young people and sexuality is a changing thing.
Yeah.
You know, and the film isn't explicit about their sexualities, and I think that's maybe where I give it kind of a pass in that sense. And I can see why people might say it's queer baiting as well, but I think if I read it as a film about male intimacy in general, and we can talk about whether it's a romantic relationship and all, but to me these things don't really matter. It to me it's more about male intimacy, and I think that's something that's like quite interesting.
Yeah.
And so I kind of think give Don't a pass for this film compared to Girl, which I think is much more tricky and much more iffy.
Yeah
It's this is a tricky one.
Yeah.
But I will say this thing, and I wrote this in my top 10 list, you guys can read it later, which is that this year when I thought about the movies that I liked, I kind of just decided I just need to go with my feelings rather than like thinking too much about technical merits and stuff. So like this is the year that I was like, okay, I'm just gonna go with my feelings in terms of like films that really speak to me.
Good.
And I think it kind of becomes clear with my top 10 list that a lot of it has to do with that
feeling,
like me thinking about how do I feel about the films and using the feelings and emotions of myself to lead me to the films that I personally appreciate the most. Yeah.
That's great.
Back to you, Wilson.
Yeah, my next four picks are sort of movies that we've talked about already, so I'm going to try to use this time. I'm going to read out the picks, but I'm going to try to use this time to fit in some other movies.
All right. I thought you were going to use this time to speed it up.
Sorry, Ben.
What?
My number eight is Maniratnam's Pony and Selvan Part 2. You can listen to our episode on it to hear my thoughts on it. Great movie.
Shout out Thanmai.
Shout out to Thanmai. My number seven is Across the Spider-Verse. Not going to say too much about it. It was a blast. I saw it twice, so it's confirmed 4.5 stars. Great time. Just wish it came with the back half attached to it, and now we don't have to wait.
Yeah.
And now I feel bad for like thinking about all these animators that are just going through hell right now trying to finish this movie. So sorry to those animators. You really just take your time. If it takes 3 years, go for it. It's fine. Do not rush yourselves. My number six pick is Todd Haynes' May December. You can check out our episode on it. I talked extensively about why I love the movie. And my number five pick is The Zone of Interest, Jonathan Glazer. We talked about this earlier.
Wow.
Very effective movie. Okay, I'm going to use this time because I'm down to four right now. So I'm going to use this time to list a few things that I really, really love. My number 11 pick, Ben, you talk about male friendship. I think this is my favorite male friendship movie of the year. It is Felix Van Gornhens and Charlotte Vandermeersch, The Eight Mountains. This sort of decade-spanning view on this friendship between these two boys, a city boy and a country boy. And later on in life, they build a house together, and it's so beautiful. I I think it just speaks to these special connections that you have with people in your life that you can just really never, you can never be rid of. And I think the performances are fantastic. Mm. I was able to track this relationship through so many years, and I felt like I lived a life through watching this movie. So great, great movie. Would definitely recommend The Eight Mountains.
If this is your way of asking, yes, I will build a house with you two in 60 years.
Let's do it. Oh, wow. Yes.
In 60 years, I'm going to be dead.
Or now. I don't know. I've got nothing going on tomorrow. Let's build a house.
Let's do it. Let's do it, Eli.
We built a house.
We bought a zoo.
They should have called it that. Did any of you catch this?
We bought a zoo.
I was trying to, but just the 3-hour runtime made it really difficult to fit into my schedule.
Yeah. Understandably.
But you didn't catch my suggestion, which was Delinquents, which is not quite the same, but you should watch it. I think based on what you're saying about this, I think you will like The Delinquents.
I think I will.
Which is like number 15 on my list.
Nice.
Pretty high.
Shout out Argentine cinema. You had a good run. Sorry that your new president wants to cut public funding to the arts.
Oh shit.
What a world.
Were you going to shout out more, Wilson?
Can I shout out one more? I'm going to shout out one more.
Yeah.
This is Trent and Hung's The Taste of Things. This is my number 12 movie of the year. Eli just watched it and didn't buy it.
Boo. He hated it.
Bad movie.
He didn't like The Taste of Things.
No.
Honestly, I liked it more than I liked the Wiseman documentary.
Wow.
Whoa. It's like crazy. Yeah. Whoa. I just think it's so simple. I think the unspoken 20-minute opening where they're just cooking is so good, and this quiet like immersion leads to empathy for these characters and their relationship to each other. And I think their relationship to the food that they make is something so honorable, and I think it's something that I bought here. Binoche is fantastic. Yeah, I want to hear what you thought about it, Eli, but yeah, I really loved it.
She's a very warm performer. She's always undeniable, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Just always bright and effervescent on screen. Very comforting presence.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't buy it. Where you would say it's simple, I think it's simplistic. It is distracted and has a weirdly prioritized edit. Whereas the Wiseman documentary has the patience to understand that cooking is not just the actions itself, it's the things in between. This movie has like cooking montages, not cooking sequences, that are structured like scenes. Furthermore, not to pile things on, but like, I don't believe these performers as cooks who have worked for decades. Their work is sloppy.
Oh my God.
The edit also has so much of people walking from point A to point B. It's sloppily told. It's Manic Pixie Dream Cook.
Oh.
I'm plagiarizing my Letterboxd review here. It's setting up an arc where he changes his understanding of what a relationship is, and that doesn't happen. The whole last act of the movie is just waiting for nothing to pay off. It's only soured since I've watched it. This is the only movie I saw this year that I'm really down on, and it's the last one I watched.
Wow, Eli. Wow.
Coming from with this, Eli, and I don't disagree. I think the movie is fine. It's a bit too self-indulgent, definitely. Mm. It's not really doing anything.
It's constantly golden hour. It can't always be golden hour.
Yes, when you're cooking that kind of food.
It's the kind of thing where you watch it because it looks nice and that's it. It's kind of a hollow movie, I would say. It's still a hollow movie.
I agree. That's a good way to put it.
Did I enjoy it? Yes, to a certain extent, but it is a bit of a hollow movie, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Let's move on.
Sorry.
Let me put them next to each other, The Taste of Things and The Trois Gros on my list.
Cool.
They are next to each other in my list.
They are now next to each other on my list. Anyway, next.
While we're tossing out movies that we've already covered, I'll say that in my list are Menu Plaisir, Les Trois Gros, Monster, and some others that we'll get to a little bit later.
Ooh.
Are these your top 10?
Hmm?
Monster and Les Trois Gros?
No, I'm just sort of jumping around to things that I want to mention more than things that are in my top 10.
I don't even know what's in your top 10. I'm so confused.
That's fine.
Eli doesn't rank things.
No, but we don't need to know the rank.
Numbers are just a concept, man.
We just need to know if they are in. Are they in?
I don't know.
Are they in or out?
It's going to shift.
Have we talked about any movies that are in your top 10?
Your top 10,
okay,
yeah.
Movies that are definitely in my top 10. Skinamarink.
Oh.
This year in horror was fun because Skinamarink exists.
Wow.
It's a movie that I watched the first 30 minutes of in one sitting and was like, I think I get it. Okay. And I put it aside. And then I returned to it and I was so unnerved for the rest of the runtime. It's very simple. It has a risky formal gambit. It's like trying to do a Bresson thing, but with house. I think it's very effectively scary. And I was really unnerved and I jumped a lot. And it also got me thinking about fatherhood and childhood and suburbia and this very American obsession with the house as a space that is supposed to be for domestic comfort, but is riddled with anxiety and dread and terror. I know this is a Canadian movie, but oh well.
You'll claim it.
We'll claim that one. We'll take that one. Yeah, I think it's so effective. I really loved it. I really strongly recommend it.
That's a movie that I didn't get to this year, and I would love to check it out because I've heard really, really interesting things about it.
I would really love to know what you both think of it.
Is it back to me now?
Yeah, it's you, Ben.
Yeah, go for it.
Where am I? Where is my list?
Oh, I'm doing this wrong.
What do you mean you're doing it wrong?
Oh, on my list, I have my number four as number one because I separated it from my top three.
Oh.
My numbering's all wrong. Never mind. It's fine. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Oh, the numbers that you were saying.
It's fine.
Oh, no.
Why did you do that?
It's okay. The top three will exist outside of my top 10. It'll just be my upper echelon three.
So you're doing top 13 now?
Listeners at home, adjust your ballot ranking for Wilson's movies.
Yeah.
Okay, I was just doing number seven. So my number six, we talked about already in episode, it's Reichardt Showing Up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I will say, like, I think the watching of it, I was like, oh, it's okay. But I think about it and I feel good about it when I think about it. And that's why it's up there.
Yeah.
Confident little movie about making art.
Mm-hmm. Very confident.
Perfectly said.
Good stuff. My number four, which is actually my number seven, is a movie that I think Eli is going to talk about as well.
Oh.
And I really loved it. It is Iris Sachs' Passages.
Yeah.
What can I say? I get so excited talking about this movie because it's so crazy.
It is.
Yeah. And I think Ben Whishaw as this, like, tortured man caught in this, like, fucking black hole that Franz Rogowski's character is like sort of creating him in himself is, oh my god, it's I like don't have many words to describe this movie, but it is such a blast. I think we need more bi representation in cinema, and I think this was perfect bisexual representation. And Franz Rogowski's character is so chaotic in it, and he's just like, I think this sort of perpetual like cycle that we see him go through, like going between Adele Exarchopoulos's character and Ben Whishaw's character back and forth. It's just like I couldn't believe what I was watching, and I'm so thrilled I got to see it in a theater. So yeah.
It's absolutely in my top 10 too. And similarly, I feel giddy about it. I had seen Little Men before and I really love that movie. Very, very different movie.
Yeah.
This movie is erotic and dangerous, and it borders on laughing at Franz Rogowski, but it just narrowly avoids it because it really focuses on this problem of unknowability and unpredictability in relationships. Like, to me, the central question is, can Franz Rogowski's character really love? Is he working on his own definition of love? And is he worthy of love as both he and his partners define it?
Yeah.
It edges towards this utopian balance of a new type of relationship structure that he can't help but shake the balance of and lose everything.
Yeah.
This all feels encapsulated to me by the central directorial choice, which is dorsal framing, filming characters from behind.
Mm-hmm.
And those key moments when you can't see Franz Rogowski's face and you see him reveal something upsetting or upending to Ben Whishaw, and you just get to see Ben Whishaw's reaction.
Oh.
So effective and troubling and a little funny and horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like watching this failure to connect, it's sad and it is moving.
Yeah.
And also funny.
And I think it's one of those films that it's like, oh, it's so great to be watching this from like the confines of a theater and not like experience this firsthand.
No one wants to experience that. I will say I was much colder on this film than both of you were, which is a bummer because I thought I would kind of be into it, but I just thought it was a little too short, which was my main problem with it.
Oh, interesting.
And I think because of its tight 90, but I think this is the kind of thing where like I wish it was not 90 minutes. And I think it really needed room to breathe for me because it was going by so fast in a way that I couldn't really get a sense of the characters. It was just like, look at them do crazy shit. And I was like, okay. And because of that, it didn't feel too real to me. It felt a little too like I heard this crazy story and then I don't really believe it kind of vibe. So I think if it just like gave me just maybe another 15 minutes where we can like really sit with what is going on here from like, say, Ben's perspective and also like see what is going through Rogowski's mind when he's making crazy decisions. That would make it work better for me. But right now it's a little schematic in the way that like was a bit too difficult to kind of like let it walk on me.
I think it holds you away from that interiority from Rogowski until like the final passages. I'm not doing, no pun intended, of the movie. And then you really do sit and kind of think about those questions that you didn't have access to earlier on. Do you both know the autobiographical components of this movie?
Yeah, I think I told you about the autobiographical components of the movie.
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, you might, that might have been you. Sorry, I don't want to steal your thunder. You reveal
No,
it.
It's okay. It's okay. You go ahead, Eli.
That Iris Sachs and his partner, who's a man, co-parent their child with Kirsten Johnson, director of Camera Person.
Unreal.
And they live like right next door to each other. I feel like this movie is imagining.
Yes.
What if that didn't work?
like, let's imagine the worst case scenario of our relationship context.
Yeah, kind of.
What if that was a shit show?
Great. Okay, Eli.
Last one I'll shout out, which is not in my top 10, but I think is kind of, to borrow friend of the show Russell Goldman's assessment, is kind of a miracle that it made it through the Netflix original movie pipeline while being original and legitimately good, is They Clone Tyrone, a great little sci-fi thriller with John Boyega and Jamie Foxx and Teyana Paris, directed by Jewel Taylor, which is a name that I will be keeping an eye on for sure. Great thriller, a good hook. It's socially pointed. It's not the most deep thing ever, but it really does have something to say and do. I enjoyed it a lot.
That's great. I will put it on my watch list.
This totally like missed my radar.
Yeah.
I like did not think about it at all.
Yeah. I think it came out Barbenheimer weekend.
Oh.
Okay.
To its detriment.
That's unfortunate.
Bad timing.
Barbenheimer Clone Tyrone.
Okay.
I tried.
Sorry, I'm a little distracted right now. Okay, I'm good. Oppenheimer is number 5 for me, so I'm going to number 4.
Nice.
Which is a film I watched twice in the theaters. And this is Yorgos Lanthimos' Poor Things. Which I think isn't a very smart movie and isn't even a very great feminist movie, to be honest. But it's very fun. And I think it's really carried by performances. And Emma Stone has this Best Actress on lock. There is no denying it. She's got it. I don't see anybody else winning this. Because it's a kind of Oscar bait performance. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like big physical transformation, extreme things that you're doing to yourself, being naked. Like these are things that win you Oscars. Are they good reasons to get an Oscar? No, but they are reasons that you do get an Oscar. So definitely, I think she's got it. But I think the film is just really fun to watch. And the production design is like insane. Like, it's definitely a better Barbie movie than Barbie actually is. Kind of the same movie. It's maybe kind of like Oppenheimer, less intelligent than it would like to seem. But I think it's a really good time. And I think Mark Ruffalo's Duncan something.
Donuts?
Forgot the name of the character. Duncan Wedderburger? I don't think it's Wedderburger. I don't think the word burger is in it. But it's very good and very funny. And like, his owl that's in the trailer is probably the single best line reading in cinema last year.
Oh, so,
yeah.
When she slaps him.
Yeah, and he goes, ow, ow.
Oh.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. He does a lot with that character and it really works.
Aww.
And Emma Stone's also really freaking fantastic, actually, with the physicality of her acting and the way that she's tracking the development of this character over time is really good.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I think it's a good time.
Yeah.
Cool.
I'll be seated opening night in 2 weeks.
Oh, nice.
I think this is my last pick because my number 6 is Koreeda's Monster, which you will hear me talking about in another episode. And my number 4 is Nolan's Oppenheimer. So the last movie I have to talk about is number 5. And it is unfortunately the only animated film that I will talk about this year. And it is not The Boy and the Heron. It is another anime called Blue Giant by Yuzuru Tachikawa. It is based on a manga. It is about three young men, one of which we follow who moves to Tokyo in search of becoming the greatest jazz saxophonist in the world. And they sort of come together and form a band. And it's about the trials and tribulations of being like bandmates and striving to achieve like a great form of art in this sort of like back and forth improv-y way that jazz is. And it was super moving. I went in blind and like cried 3 times as you do in an anime movie. The soundtrack made by Hiromi, a famous jazz musician, is incredible. I like still have it on loop today. It is something that a lot of people have slept on, even though it was released on like early December in the States by G Kids. Shout out G Kids. I love you guys. It's just a really great movie with a very strong narrative and emotional through line to it that I related to. And I like just can't fault it. It's 10 out of 10.
Awesome.
Okay, sweet.
This was a movie I was trying to watch last night, but I was too tired. Oh. I was really trying to sneak it in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, what's going to get me tonight?
Yeah.
Maybe anime.
Yeah. 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 Jazz anime. Go for it. I think, Eli, you would also really, really enjoy it for the musical aspects to it.
I hadn't heard of it before. It sounds great.
Check it out. Check it out.
I don't have another feature that we've not discussed that I really want to put on the table, but I will put out there that friend of the show, past and future guest, film festival correspondent extraordinaire, Russell Goldman, had another short film that hit the festival circuit this past year and should be online, I'm guessing, a little bit later this year, called Closing Time. All I'll say in terms of plot is that there's a college reunion and something is wrong. This is just really sharp directorial work, and the whole team that Russell's working with is phenomenal. Our friend Ali, cinematography,
woo!
Casting director Jamie Ember, really did phenomenal work. This is a must-see cast. I think it's a great short, and I really strongly recommend it.
Great.
Are we on to our top three now?
I'm left with top three, man.
Damn. Wait, can I quickly run through a quick list of movies that I suggest people check out before we dive in?
For sure.
Oh, okay, yeah, sure. Run through your top 50.
50. I watched like close to 90 2023 releases this year, which was pretty outstanding for me. But I think it was really helped by the film festival. I want to shout out Ulrich Seidel's Sparta, D. Smith's Kokomo City, Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin, Lila Alvarez's Totem, Anhui's Elegies, Panahi's No Bears, and Matt Johnson's Blackberry. Those are the movies that I'm suggesting. All great movies.
Cool.
Ooh, let me see. Do I have anything I want to shout out? Maybe the only other thing I want to shout out is this film called Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World by Roddy, which I thought was really interesting. Did I love it? No, but really interesting from working. He's definitely a filmmaker to watch and like to think about. Very idiosyncratic filmmaking compared to anything else on my list this year, probably. Yeah. Fascinating, angry filmmaker. And I think you will like him, Eli.
Raduju.
More incisive, angry stuff.
Good. I will add that to my list. I'll use my 10-second recommendation to say that I think the best movie that I watched this year, not a 2023 movie, but A Brighter Summer Day by Edward Yang, that's really been sticking with me. It's devastating and I think a shamefully important movie.
It's time.
Perhaps we will be saying more about that soon.
It's time. 2024 is the year, guys. It's the year of Yang. It needs to happen.
Yeah,
I agree.
It needs to happen this year.
I agree.
I gotta wait. It's gonna happen near the end of the year for us, I think. Because of things I know.
There's
some screenings coming.
Okay. Should we drum roll? Boom, 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 boom. And this is our top three. We are going to start up with Eli's number three pick of 2023.
Very well. My number three pick is one that we've already talked about on a Deep Cut Upkeep. And it is Kelly Reichardt's Showing Up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've already spoken at length about my relationship with this movie, but I'll just say that in terms of those categories that I laid out at the start of the episode, this very much so is gentle and calm and pleasant, while also really critically thinking about what does it mean to live the art life, which is just life.
Mm.
How do you be in community with other people and your own self? How do you pursue something that you love while expressing care for other people? These are questions that everyone thinks about in one way or another. And it has stayed with me for almost a year and a half now as sitting at the top of my list.
Wow.
Number three, Kelly Reichardt, Showing Up. A beautiful movie.
Awesome.
Watch it. Listen to our episode.
Yes,
please.
Do that.
Do it.
Okay, I don't know if you guys will expect this from me. This is my number three.
I'm so excited.
And it's an adaptation of a book.
Adaptation of a book.
Oh,
it's an adaptation of a young adult novel by Judy Blume. It's Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
Oh, yeah. Great pick.
This is my number three. I can't really explain this pick across above the rest of my top 10 list, but I think I just watched this alone, surrounded by teen girls, and I was like really into the movie, and I was really feeling the warmth of it. And I think a lot of it is on the shoulders of Rachel McAdams' mom character, which really made you feel like, oh, like that you were being mothered by her as you're watching this movie, which is a great feeling.
Mother
McAdams. Yeah, and I think it was just such a great adaptation, which I haven't read the book, but like, I think the way that she tells the story, it's very simple.
Mm.
It's a pick for me to celebrate. A kind of back to basics kind of filmmaking, where it's just let me tell the story, this coming of age tale, make it good, well performed, well written, well paced. Everything about it is great. And if you compare it to the rest of the films in my list, there's nothing showy about it. It's a very simply told story that's full of warmth about family and a good time in the movies. Yeah,
love that.
That's my number three.
I think you'd always rely on Kelly Fremont Craig to make a good movie about coming of age as a woman.
Yeah.
Definitely one of those.
Mm.
Yeah, like a previous film. I'm not sure if that was her last film. Age of 17 is also great.
Yeah, that was her last film. It's been a while.
Wow, that was a while ago, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I've not seen the movie, but I read the book for the first time earlier this year in the context of working with students.
Oh.
And that's a really special text. That's like a great, great book.
It's great.
I think you will like this too, Eli.
I should watch it.
It's a great movie. Yeah.
I've read the book and I watched the movie, and it's a really faithful adaptation. And I think it holds the core of the book. Like, it just holds the same core, which is all you can ask for in a good adaptation.
That's right.
Mm. My number three pick is a movie that to me feels so elusive. It's sort of like playing cat and mouse with this movie. It's hard to expect what's to come, even though it's sort of laid out very clearly in front of you. The directions that this movie takes is what like really struck me as cool choices. Like it just feels like a cool movie. And this is Justine Triet's Anatomy of a Fall.
Oh yeah.
From the opening sequence, I was immediately taken aback. I was like, why is this music so loud? What the fuck's happening here? Like, all these weird things that are placed in the first few minutes of the movie come into play later on in the film in such a big way as we sort of dive into this court case against Sandra Hüller's character, who's accused of killing her husband. And it's never for me a question of, oh, did she do it or did she not? Which is, I guess, what you want someone to get out of a movie when you're making something that's sort of like murder mystery-esque. I don't think that was like my main concern watching it. I think I was just so swept by these directorial choices, these weird like zooms or weird angles, these weird flashback structures. It felt like Trier was just like, fuck it, I'm operating on my own level. I'm not gonna like think about conventions of filmmaking at all, and I'm gonna develop my own way of telling this story, which is sort of centered on this experience of this woman going through this trial and also the views that others have of her, especially her son. I do want to shout out that child performance, which is sort of like, yeah, nothing short of incredible, where he really comes toe-to-toe with a lot of incredible performances in this film. And also that dog, which is
that dog.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Ridiculous dog.
Got that dog in me.
Yeah.
Give the dog an Oscar.
Dogsker.
Yeah. If you haven't seen this film and it's like available to you, like I don't know what to say. Like, just go watch it. Yeah. That's my number three pick.
It's such a great thrill ride. Yeah. This is a perfect segue because Anatomy of a Fall is my number two spot.
Woo!
It's such a thrilling, fun movie. Similarly to what I said about Succession, it is one that I keep on thinking about and going back to. What you said, Wilson, about it throwing out the book and rebuilding a grammar, to me, it's like Trier is taking that book and folding origami out of it. The key point to me feels like it is taking these pieces of film grammar that we have been conditioned to understand as things that reveal something essential or true. The zoom that draws our attention, the cut to a flashback that we believe is objective, the close-up on the face that's supposed to reveal emotion. These things, where they would normally tell us the intention of the director and the feeling of the character, are used instead to obfuscate what is actually going on, what the truth is. These techniques that feign the truth then leave you with a kind of like empty calorie with no truth really there are about, most fundamentally, how film techniques overall do not elucidate. Film as a medium for truth-telling is faulty at best.
Yeah.
The thing that stacks on top of that is that because this is so embedded within a movie about a trial, it feels like it's making an argument about the legal and justice system as a faulty arena through which to divine the truth. A really effective, thematically sharp movie, and also just a total banger, thriller, fun watch.
Yeah.
I'm all in on this one.
Yeah.
I think it's my favorite viewing experience of the year in terms of like a movie that I really loved and enjoyed. But it's not my number one.
I think I know what Eli's number one is.
Yeah, you probably do.
But I'm going to talk about my number two, which we've already talked at length about, which is Todd Haynes' May December.
Yeah.
Which, the more I think about the movie, I think it's just such a well-constructed, well-considered, well-written movie, well-performed across the board, just like tens across the board. I think this is just Todd Haynes and team working at a very high level. And you can listen to the podcast episode that we have on this. It's just so well made, and there's something that sinks under your skin when you think about it, and yet also a good time to watch. And I love that it's just not typical of the mainstream Hollywood cinema. The way that it approaches its story, the way that it approaches something sensational and kind of desensationalizes it, contrary to what everyone makes you think about the movie, it's actually not camp at all. It is something that's almost slow and methodical, and even with kind of Haynes's heightened sensibility, there's a kind of veracity to it that's hard to explain that he's able to bring out even while using very kind of cinematic techniques. You know, he's not using like handheld or whatever to like give you the truth, but he's still making it look interesting and well thought out. But there's something about it that feels very true, even with these like big name actresses to the cast as well. And of course, shout out to Charles Melton, who also is putting on a career making performance in this film. May December. I'm really looking forward to this coming out to theaters in a few weeks. So I'm going to watch that again. In the big screen.
I'm so excited for you.
Yeah.
Okay. My number two pick is something that I caught at Hong Kong International Film Festival earlier last year. It is a documentary that I talked about at length. It is Elvis Liu's A Holy Family. I don't think it will ever get U.S. distribution, but that being said, well, I think now is a good time for me to talk about it. You can listen back on the episode, but it's basically a documentary about this guy who's a filmmaker who returns to his family, who's a very like devout spiritual family that he sort of escaped from when he was younger in order to move to the city and become a filmmaker. And it's about his complicated relationship with his family and over the course of the next few years, trying to rebuild his connection with his parents and with his brother. I think this is an incredibly intimate and open and raw film. And I think it's so rare to see documentaries where you put yourself at the center of the film and you try to, through the film, you sort of examine your own relationship to family. I don't feel like I don't think I could do it. I think it really spoke to me in the way that a lot of these Asian films about family examine this complicated relationship or push and pull between parents and children and these different ideologies, but still ending up on the side of like care and love and duty, like at least in this sort of like Confucian idea of family structure and what you need to do. This is probably like the most personal pick from me out of the 10. So yeah, it is a very well-told, quiet documentary. Check it out. It's called A Holy Family.
That's great.
It's online.
Okay.
Hey.
Okay.
We're here.
We're on to our number one movies.
We're here.
I went back and forth on Anatomy of a Fall versus my number one pick because whereas Anatomy of a Fall might have been my favorite movie of the year, I think the best, most essential, richest text that we have in cinema this year is May, December.
Oh,
yeah, I knew it.
You knew it.
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. Well, now you know.
I know Eli better than you.
Yeah.
No, you both know me. It is the great American rot in a motion picture, unlike I've seen it before. In a motion picture. It's a movie that I will be rewatching many times in my life in the same way that I approach like A Separation, which listeners of the pod will know is a movie that has meant a lot to me and I keep on going back to as a text that is instructive and at the same time deconstructs human pathology and emotion without over-explaining those things. Mm-hmm. It is the most biting movie of the year. It is the most devastating movie of the year. There's so much going on here. It is an incredibly intelligent construction while also being emotionally effective. A great, great movie.
Yeah.
Agreed.
I love that.
Ben?
I think my number one pick shows the difference between me and Eli.
Ooh.
Oh.
Because my number one pick is actually...
It's Anatomy of a Fall.
Justin Trier's Anatomy of a Fall.
Yeah.
Because where Eli like decides to pick the one that he thinks is the most well-made movie, I picked the one that I thought was more fun.
Yay!
Similarly, it was probably my favorite time in the movies in 2023 because I watched this alone but surrounded by French people. In the very first row, sitting at the foot of the screen, and I had a blast because I was laughing my ass off alongside all these other French people. So I knew I wasn't wrong. I wasn't laughing at them. I was laughing with them. And French Court is a riot. And I thought it was such a funny movie. And yet I think, as you guys have been mentioning, is so good at kind of deconstructing the idea of what truth really is and whether truth really matters in the context of its case. As well as you pointed out, in the context of cinema, as well as the reality. And I think the fact that she's able to make a film that is this fun, but also this intelligent and this innovative, and with so many just like, she's just trying stuff out and like making it in an idiosyncratic, but very easy to digest way. And this is a 2.5 hour movie and did not feel that way at all.
No.
And there are some really standout scenes in this film.
Yeah.
For example, the one we talked about, I think before, which is like the one where there's a voiceover during a scene that you were watching, but all the dialogue is by like the person telling the testimony. And great zooms in the court on the judges, on the lawyers.
Oh, hot lawyer.
I think they're both hot.
I don't know. I just think it was such a good time at the theaters and I really, really liked it. I hear there's some super cuts of hot lawyer on the internet.
Oh, yeah. And hot prosecutor as well. He's entered the ring. Bald prosecutor.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Anatomy of a fan cam.
Yeah. So, I mean, since I've seen this, it's been at the top of my list because it's really like, you know what? It kind of reminds me almost like old school Hollywood, but like not. I don't know why. Yeah.
Like a Billy Wilder.
Yeah, like something like that. Yeah. But like with modern sensibilities and like techniques and ideas of how the film can look. And can be like.
I think that's on Trier's mind, even in the title of the movie, citing Preminger's Anatomy of a Murder.
That's true.
True.
That's
so true. So true.
True, true, true.
Good pick, Ben.
Okay. It's my turn.
Wilson.
It's my turn. And yeah, Ben knows me very well because he called it very early on in our recording. My number one pick is Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. I've never pegged myself as a Scorsese fan, like not at all. Like I don't know if I still am a Scorsese fan. I saw Raging Bull for the first time this year and like didn't really like it that much. But this was outstanding. It was hard for me. Like I think both times I saw it, I walked away from watching this movie shell-shocked. And I think that has to do with a lot of different things. I think the script is very powerful in how it sort of buries us down into the rot of what was happening to the Osage Nation at that time. And I think the elongated runtime and that edit that doesn't really let us breathe, at least for the first two acts of things, it really feels suffocating and it feels like you're getting pummeled down beat after beat. And it's intentional. Scorsese wants you to comprehend these atrocities that these white people made on the Osage Nation. And I think you can put this in comparison with an Oppenheimer or a Zone of Interest, which sort of shows us an outsider's view of, or like a very closed off view of war atrocities and doesn't really confront the violence and the pain that it causes. But I think Scorsese, with the help and the blessing of the Osage Nation today, tells this story with a lot of truth and a lot of heart. And I think even in its coda and its ending where Scorsese appears himself, he sort of comprehends for a slight minute him being a white man telling this story of indigenous pain and suffering and sort of the setbacks that that itself has. I think the performances all around are sort of jaw-dropping. I think a lot of people talk about Gladstone's performance, which is really heartbreaking and moving, but I think DiCaprio probably gives one of my favorite performances of his here as sort of this dumb-ish man who gets caught up, but then rather than choose to sort of put a stop to this cycle of pain and violence, makes an active choice, or not an active that we see, but makes a choice, makes a slow choice to continue perpetuating this violence. And it is something that feels within reach, and I think when it is within reach, I think it feels very scary to see that transformation. Yeah, it just really affected me. I don't know if the next time I'll like hold a Scorsese movie in such high regard, but the Thelma Schoonmaker edit moves so fast, and I think I was held for the whole runtime, and yeah, crazy for me to think that the Scorsese would be my number one at the end of the year. But that's it. It's Killers of the Flower Moon. That's my number one movie.
Wow.
Did you see this, Eli?
I did not.
Oh, you haven't seen this. Interesting. I think this is probably one of Scorsese's best. I think also because of the way that he's approaching it with like a newfound like maturity that honestly, like when I say newfound, I mean like quite recently. I don't mean like in his later years. I mean like the last 5 years, last less than 10 years, where like he really decided to think about what he was doing with his material. Because Scorsese has always been in the middle of that blender conversation of like, is he glorifying the violence or like the crime that he's showing?
Even as recently as Silence.
Yeah, and I think in Killers of the Flower Moon, he leaves it almost absolutely clear that he does not condone what he's showing.
Yeah.
It feels the most clear of any of that. Mm. And because it is so cruel, he's not having fun with it. It is not a fun movie to watch.
No.
It is a painful movie to watch. And I think that's why it's not in my top 10, because I was just like, this is not nice. And
yeah,
it's not really his fault. It's just this is the approach he's doing it. And kind of like reading a book, actually. Like, here's just what happened and this is shitty.
Yeah.
And because it is based on this book. Yeah, and so I think it is a very daring film that he has made.
Yeah.
At his age, especially, his age. Like, to see that kind of evolution is really quite impressive, I would say. So even though I didn't love this movie, I really, really respect it. I really respect what he's doing with it. Yeah, so I think it is a fine movie. Yeah. Yeah. And to be that person to, like, reconsider your relationship with cinema and the way that your making of a film is not distanced from the material is quite a feat, I think. Yeah.
It's really impressive.
Yeah. Color me excited for whatever he's going to do next as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. After seeing this from him.
He's making another Jesus movie. That's what he's doing.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
That's right.
Cool. Cute. That's it.
That's 2023.
Wow.
Wow.
Justin Trier made the best movie of the year.
Wow. Yeah.
Landed on all three of our lists.
Has that happened? Did that happen in previous years where we all had a movie on our top three?
I don't know.
The same movie. I don't think it has.
Yeah.
It's pretty fantastic. Wow.
Well, to close things out, what are some plans that you have this year in the way of movie watching or even the podcast? What can we leave our listenership with?
I feel like last year and the year before were sort of years where I didn't feel like I had time to put into the podcast. And I feel like this year I'm going to try to make it pretty intentional, like prepping for the podcast and doing the podcast, because I enjoy it a lot. And I think it gets me to discover a lot more cinema with you guys. And I think it's really fun to do. And I want to like sort of continue exploring other directors. As with movie watching, I, in a similar vein, I don't want to catch as many new releases this year. I feel like last year my watching was like plagued by 2023 releases, for better or for worse.
Mm.
So I want to just go back and watch some old movies. I feel like my body's itching for it. Yeah, I hope we get to see each other this year. I think that is something that's in the books. So hopefully we can also record an episode in the flesh for the first time since we started this podcast. So that's something that I'm really, really looking forward to.
Agreed. Hear, hear.
I feel like I say this every year as well, which is trying to watch fewer movies from the year, which I did last year. I mean, 2023. But I'm trying to catch up on 2023 in the next few weeks still, because I think there's still a lot of films that I haven't caught that like I'm kind of excited about. I think my main regret, if you could call it that, for 2023 is that I didn't have like a filmmaker that I discovered that I really, really liked, where it was like a filmography that I dove into. Because I think almost every year since we started the podcast, there was one filmmaker every year that'd be like, oh my God, this is my person this year that I'm really interested in.
Like, it was your Romare year the year before.
Right.
I had a Romare year, I had a Reichardt year, I had a Kinuyo Tanaka year, you know what I mean? Those are like the discoveries, you know? And 2023, I didn't have that, which was a bummer. So I'm hoping to really dive into some filmmakers this year. And some of the filmmakers I'm put on my list are not even new to me filmmakers, but just filmmakers maybe I want to rediscover and relook at.
Do you want to say a few names that are on that list?
Oh, names on that list. Let's see. David Lynch is somebody I'm trying to rediscover a little bit.
Nice.
Because it's been a long time since I saw any of his features. So I want to go back in and like rewatch all of them. Naruse I want to get into this year.
Fucking lit. Yeah, me too.
William Friedkin as well.
Mm.
A weird big blind spot for me, Brian De Palma.
Mm.
I still have not seen a single De Palma film fully.
Ooh,
wow.
I've only seen half of Scarface. And yet I've seen the De Palma documentary by Noah Baumbach. Yeah, so these other filmmakers are kind of swimming around, thinking about kind of digging into this year. But maybe I'll find something different. Maybe you guys will introduce someone to me.
Cool. I hope so too.
Love that idea.
I know so. I know so because I, in my mind, I have plans.
What about you, Eli?
For me, in terms of movie watching, I think I want to continue in the vein that I've been doing it, where it's not necessarily my priority, but I come and go to it as I want to. And it's been more meaningful and rich because of that. Because if I really want to go see something, then I do it. And I make it a purposeful, focused experience. And I like that. I also hope that I find a good discovery this year, something that makes me feel really enthused and intellectually excited and emotionally moved. I hope that our community on Discord continues to grow. I feel really grateful for that. And, you know, like Barg and Losix and Kia, Thanmai and Max and all the people who are on there and contribute. It's really fun to get to know them and interact with them. So shout out to you all, too, if you're listening.
Yay.
Top priority this year is getting to see you both.
Yeah.
I think that that will be an absolute highlight of the year that I'm so looking forward to.
Deep cut live.
100%.
To watch a movie together and spend time together.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
In sweaty old Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not old, sorry. Sweaty new Singapore.
Yeah, we're a young country.
Thank you both, as always, for being a part of my movie watching. I'd say it's become one of the primary motivating factors for me watching any movie is getting to discuss it with you both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I'm excited to get back into like director series with you guys.
Yeah.
I like our upkeeps because I think it like keeps these directors in conversation. But I think discovering new directors is something that I get the thrill out of the most. Out of what we do on the podcast.
Yeah.
Agreed. Excited to get back to it.
Yeah, I think we need to get it moving because I love doing the podcast. I love talking about movies with you guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I need to watch more movies.
Yeah, let's make moves.
Let's do it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Deep Cut. Please rate and review because that helps us keep making the show. Be sure to subscribe to us where you listen to podcasts so you'll know when our next episode drops. You can keep up with us on Instagram and Letterboxd at Deep Cut Pod. And join us to talk about movies on our Discord server, to which you'll find a link in the description. You can share with us your top 10 movies of 2023 on our Discord server. I think we'd really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
Deep Cut is hosted, produced, and edited by us, Benjamin Yap, Eli Sands, and Wilson Lai. Our cover art is designed by Justina Yam, and our theme song is composed by Eli Sands.
Debuting the new mix of it, too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I'm excited.
Revamped for a new year.
I'm Wilson.
I'm Ben.
I'm Eli.
Take care, and we're looking forward to talking about more movies with you next time.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy Lunar New Year.
Happy New Year.
Year of the Dragon.
Xinnian Kuai Le. Oh, damn, I didn't make that, like, that Lunar New Year joke.
You could do it now.
Well, it feels weird now we're done editing.
Do it, do it. I'll drop it at the end.
Okay, it was Deep Cut is actually following a lunar calendar. So we do not go by Gregorian calendar rules. So instead of 2023 year in review, it would be, fuck, what came before the dragon?
Wait, what's before dragon? My God,
rabbit? Rabbit, rabbit. So it would be the year of the rabbit, year in review. Calling it.
And guys, you know, it's the year of the dragon, so we're going to be dragging these deep cuts across your ear holes.
Oh my God.
I love ear holes. That's great.